And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we have a wonderful ally just backstage that we will introduce in some moments. But first, some announcements from our allies. So our wonderful ally, Jean Hayes, our KFCF ally in Fresno, loves us to introduce something very wonderful happening this March 19th. It's the Fresno Earth Democracy invites you to a free workshop, Enlightened Apocalypse, Paying It Forward to Save Mother Earth. Life on our home planet is disappearing. How did we let this happen? Let's look back, learn from our mistake, and make plans. It's a free workshop. It's Saturday, March 19th at 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Arte Americas, 1630 Van Ness Avenue in Fresno. First Nations opening ceremony promptly at 9 a.m. There will be Indigenous Philosophy of Mother Earth by the local First Nations people. Walt Shubin will present on the San Joaquin River then and now. Lloyd Carter on water, nowhere to be found. And, of course, that will be March 19th when there's a wonderful conference, The Call of the Forest, going on in Point Reyes. But thanks to my wonderful radio guests of the last 2 weeks, Diana Beresford Kroger and Brock Dolman and Betsy Damon, that is sold out. But it does segue quite wonderfully into my Commonweal event in Bolinas, California on Sunday the 20th from 4 to 6 p.m. But you must register, and you can find out how to register at coyotenetworknews.com. So that's, you know, the Vernal Eclipse, Scheherazade convening trickster medicine storytelling, Vernal Eclipse, Palm Sunday, Venus-Neptune conjunction, fantastic romance. So the world is raging, so let's be the bomb, B-A-L-M. And really, pretty much, you know, part of our dynamic is we're electing Flora Fauna. She is our candidate. That's who we're electing. I will also be doing a version of that at Open Secret in San Rafael on March 22nd. That's Tuesday, the Lunar Eclipse Eve at 7 p.m. Also, you can register for that on the website at coyotenetworknews.com. So, in this wild astro time, it is perfect to welcome, you know, fellow astro-mytho-political colleague Eric Francis, allied in our dedication to deep-delving, investigative cahooting, and the elegant pragmatism of the astrological language. I like to say, language grants us access to the realm it describes. If we can speak of it, we can journey there. So astrology is one of the great, misunderstood until now, languages of our individual psyche's pulsing relationship to the collective dream. You know, Eric has taken his skills as a former investigative reporter, investigating the corporate crimes of Monsanto and General Electric. Yes, we can go into that, into the realm of astrology. He approaches the horoscope column as a form of mythic journalism published frequently and easy to follow. Yet it's also a platform for ideas about growth, personal development, presenting these in accessible language. Yeah, no, that's a really challenging, good thing for astrologers. Very often it's Lollapalooza and Mars and whatever. No, we want to translate it into useful English. He's been doing it for 18 years without missing an issue. Oh, the planet wave section is still a magnetizing attraction. So he has combined astrology investigative skills into a new genre of writing. His work has been carried in the Daily Mail, the Daily Mirror, and the leading British publication Woman. Today he's the horoscope writer for the Omega Institute, horoscope for Marie Claire, Chronogram, and many regional publications around the country. He's the editor-in-chief of Planet Waves, the magazine he founded in 1998, which features the work of more than a dozen writers on astrology, tarot, personal growth, and the Planet Waves specialty, the meeting of the personal and the collective. His website is planetwaves.net, and he's joining us now from his world headquarters in Kingston, New York, where he spirals out a plethora of incredible, prolific, disciplined dedication. Wow, welcome, Eric.
Yeah, Caroline, how are you?
I'm pretty okay.
Hello, California. As Wolf Blitzer once said.
I don't know if he said that, but here we are. Well, let me also bring up just a little esoteric story about St. Patrick, because it is St. Patrick's Day, and I think
it is, isn't it? I'm wearing blue and purple and yellow and in it.
But there is a wonderful story, esoteric story told of St. Patrick, who is invited to a testing dinner, and he's given a poison cup of wine. Mm-hmm. So he holds the poison cup of wine up to the light. The poison rises to the top like froth on a Guinness. He blows it off. Whoa! And he quaffs the drink, toasting everyone who tried to poison him, and as well as the guests, causing the elders to go, ah, a real initiate. So here we are approaching.
Okay, now
the
I like him.
No. Again, dig deeper. You know, the word.
I'll put on a green headband in a second.
Well, there you go. So the word respect means to look again. Look again, Eric. Re-look. You know, underneath the Muggle news is the mythic news. You know, he didn't just drive the snakes out of Ireland, for God's sake. There's an esoteric initiative. So I like this. As we convene now, the sun is quintile Pluto. So we've all been given a poison cup of wine, right? Personally and collectively. So let's hold it to the light, blow off the poison, and toast everybody, going, thank you, all poisonous politicians, for revealing the lurking poison dredged to the surface. I mean, everything, really, right?
So that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, this is the gift of Donald Trump. It's sort of seeing the poison rise to the surface.
Yeah. Right. And, well, I love Floyd Mayweather, the retired boxer, who wore a woman's Muslim headgear to a Trump rally and stood there powerful and said, anybody want to, you know, have a rustle? And he said a guy came up to him and stared him in the face and then went away. And Floyd said, I thought so, and then left. Anyway, so tricksters abound.
Little prejudice, anyone? Come on.
Yeah. No. Anyway, so that was great, and so it is. What a wild, interesting time. So, and feel free again. The power of radio magic. We can spiral forth, you know, blessings, well wishings. May everything. Well, we're investigative, right? May anything up to no good be revealed, rendered harmless, and an occasion for mirth. That's good, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
Right.
So next week, as I told you backstage, next week I will be hosting again John Rulak, who is a great founder of Nutiva, but also a great educator about GMO foods and the crisis of food in the world and how we're depleting sardines so that the creatures who depend on it are dying. But more importantly, the DARK Act, the Denying Americans the Right to Know Act, about not labeling Monsanto stuff. But you did a lot of work with Monsanto. I'm not for them, about them, and
I didn't help them. I did it for them.
Well, that's good. That's right. Because
I helped their attorneys make more money.
How did you do that?
Well, by stirring things up. You know, it gives them occasion to respond and to, you know, deal with the fact that now suddenly people know what's going on. With great help from Sierra, by the way, the Sierra Club in San Francisco, and my editor Paul Rauber, one of the great teachers who helped me do this work.
And what are some highlights of the work that you did for Monsanto? But I still don't understand how you made their lawyers, Richard. Did they sue you?
Well, no. They didn't. They didn't have any grounds to do that. Well, I guess when I say we, I mean that the entire plaintiff side seeking the truth was engaging their whole organization. And so I personally didn't do it. But on the other hand, you know, the thing is, when bad things are exposed about Monsanto, their lawyers always make more money because we have to ward it off. And so every lawsuit that's filed is good for Monsanto's lawyers. It's not necessarily good for Monsanto. And it's one of those crazy things where, you know, once a lawyer joke, well, we filed a motion and Monsanto's lawyers are going to put down some wool carpeting.
Right.
Send their kids to prep school because of this motion.
So you'd said that you'd some years back done an astrological chart for Monsanto because they have a birthday, and done articles for the Mountain Astrologer, which is a pretty great rag. So when was Monsanto born?
1901, and it was
what
it
day?
Was
what day?
Well, I'm looking at a representation of the chart. Hold on, if you like, I can tell you that. But Monsanto's sun is at 6:50 Sagittarius. So figure that out. That's in late November. But the thing about Monsanto is that, you know, Teddy Roosevelt once gave a really famous speech about trust busting. Like, he gave it like a huge speech before Congress about why we've got to get rid of these trusts. You know, trust meaning monopolies. And within 24 hours of that speech, Monsanto was formed. So there was something in the air about monopolies the day that Teddy Roosevelt told Congress that we had to bust the trusts. And it happens on that very day, too, that the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction of 1901 was within a couple of arc minutes. And this is a conjunction that happens only once every 20 years. And sometimes, because of the retrograde, it'll happen a couple of three times. But in 1901, it happened once, and when that conjunction was at its closest, Teddy Roosevelt warned the country about the power of monopolies, and Monsanto was founded by Edgar Quiney in St. Louis, who founded it with $5,000 as a saccharin manufacturing company.
Really?
Because he knew that there was a shortage there was no saccharin made in the United States, and soft drinks were the new thing in 1901. They were the big thing happening. And there was a need for saccharin, for diet soft drinks, and there was no source of saccharin in the U.S. And
pause for a moment while I marvel. So there was diet soft drinks in 1901?
Yes.
Wow. All right. Okay. Huh.
And so he got a formula, and he built a saccharin factory. And it is thanks to Coca-Cola, which basically became his biggest client, purchasing soft drink components, things like caffeine, saccharin, caramel coloring, and vanillin, and things like this, that Monsanto was built up to be the giant concern that it became. And they always had an agenda of, since early on, they had an agenda of purchasing other companies and looking for companies to buy. And one of the This was going on for, you know, the first few decades of their history, and they finally bought a company called Swan Chemical, I think, in 1935, in Anniston, Alabama, and that was the company that manufactured PCBs. And so Monsanto basically buys into the business of making these insanely toxic, environmentally persistent chemicals that were basically used in everything from plastic to surgical implants to ink and dye carriers, and with their most prolific use being in electrical equipment. And this is basically how the entire world and every milligram of blood and breast milk from every human on this planet would test positive for some form of Monsanto's PCBs.
Uh-huh.
And so we can thank Coca-Cola for
Hey Joe Kelly.
We can thank Coca-Cola for driving the success of Monsanto, and then it starts buying into genuinely evil things.
Well, that's pretty evil so far. So yes, well, take us further into evil, but let's remember also that the word translated as evil to us from Aramaic simply means unripe. So I like, what do we do with unripe things? We put them in a brown paper bag. So we imagine a giant brown paper bag coming over Monsanto. There we go. All right. So yeah. So what other evil things do we need to put in a brown paper bag that Monsanto's been up to? And do help us delineate again the complicity among even people that we want to like, the Obama administration, right? They appointed Obama.
Serious problem.
And Hillary's kind of in cahoots. Yeah.
Oh, very much so. They are very lenient on Monsanto, and you know, Monsanto's got this. There was an astrologer named Larry Eli, still living, one of the more really in the background, but one of the more brilliant people, especially at rectification. And so, on recommendation, I asked for his help to get a time for the chart for Monsanto. We needed to rectify this chart so we could have an ascendant. And he we worked for months on the rectification. We work with Ursula Fugger up in Canada, too, and I worked with them independently for a little bit of double blind. And they both came up with the same ascendant, Aquarius, and Larry said he was convinced that this chart was an electional.
Ah, yes. Sneaky up to no goodness. They
assertively. And look, I finished, I've done a lot of articles on Monsanto for a lot of different places, and this one I did for the Mountain Astrologer in 2012. Just write to me if you want it. I'll be happy to send it, or I'll put it up on my website where you can just easily find it. I actually came out of it with some respect for them. I don't like these industrialists, but I respect their tenacity and their, you know, their ability to just stop at nothing.
Well,
and that's what they did. That's what they did, and they built something very strong.
Yeah. Well, yes. It's like Octopus Enterprises, tentacles everywhere. All right, everywhere. It's like, well, like the Koch brothers. You know, spandex. They own spandex. You know, you can't escape them. Right. So the Aquarius Rising, as we know, can sell, you know, Ageless Wisdom or Pepsi Light jingles. It just puts it out there. And I guess that it's kind of a conquest hegemony. So let's tease it into what's at stake now in this powerful, tricky, cuckoo, interesting, wild year that we also call an election year, you know, where there's so much going on, but the power of story, right? And so, you know, we might say that, you know, everybody wants to know how they're being snookered, and Trump has told people, I'll tell you how you're being snookered, and it's scapegoating. It's by those people, right? And Bernie's saying, I'll tell you how we're being snookered, and here's what we're all going to do about it. You know, it's a different kind of dynamic. One's the con, one's the liberating trickster. So if we're in this realm of, you know, dominance collapsing but taking so much life with it, that would include Monsanto, I suppose, and then culture of collaborate, reverent genius kind of rising from the rubble here. And I think there's a wind, you know, and Bernie's got his sail up to catch that wind, and it is against all odds. Anything could happen. But can you guide us, you know, into the whole thing, but maybe through Monsanto and what you know about, you know, the complicity of some of the political players right now with that, and how controlling they are in so many sneaky ways, corporations like Monsanto?
Well, Monsanto's business strategy seems to be to become the government.
Yeah.
So that's how they kind of dupe the government into going along with everything, is that they become it, and they invest themselves in things that end up seeming like necessities. So by the time Monsanto was done manufacturing these things called PCBs, which were like liquid plastic that never goes away, they had convinced the insurance industry to require it everywhere.
Ooh.
So once you've convinced federal regulators in the insurance industry to require this thing, it's kind of hard to be held to account for it, because they have so successfully spread the responsibility around. Now, they are held to account every now and then, but look, you know, by the magic of corporations, they live forever. They have as much money as a country. And they're immortal. So they're a race of immortal beings that have invaded the planet. And now it is up to us to, you know, distract them and dissuade them and starve them of resources if we can. But it's tricky, especially when, you know, when I'm thinking, well, if Hillary's elected, we're going to get judges who are pro-choice and pro-Monsanto. So what are we going to have? GMO babies, I guess. We'll have... You know, what's that going to add up to?
Right.
And they are very lenient on this company that
has
done so much to harm so many people, and yet they still.
Well, yeah, and there goes my. I was thinking, and you've just corrected me. You've clarified. I was thinking, like, oh, you know, it's a little too late now, but I love the idea that Obama would nominate Hillary to the Supremes, and I thought, oh, that will get rid of her militarism and bring out her good self, and, you know, kind of separate her from Wall Street, and it would be very witty, just as but no, she's in Monsanto's pocket. So, you know, GMO babies. All right. So never mind even that whimsical bit of whimsy there. So there is that. Okay. And then Hillary's connection to Monsanto. I mean, you know, I could,
Well, I don't have it on paper.
Okay, but I mean, part of the dynamic, as you say, is, you know, the seductive insinuation, tentacles everywhere, that, you know, a lot of relatively sane people, you know, say, you know, well, if you're not for Monsanto, if you're not for GMO, then you want to starve Africa, right? And it's like, oh, that's very sneaky. Yeah. They got Bill Gates that way, going, no, you know, you know, we are scientists, we know better. You know, you people are just, you want to starve people in Africa because you're not for GMOs. And so they really have hoovered Invasion of the Body Snatchers. They've kind of sucked the brains out of people who think of themselves as scientific, you know, intellectual leaders. And we go, well, we want to liberate those people. I mean, I like stepping in as a strategy, going, yes, we are with you in your desire to feed the world. What a good idea. Good dedication, but here's, did you know, here's the other
thing. Well,
other
it doesn't. I mean, the crops don't really work, and they have to spray them intensely with Roundup and now Agent Orange. This is the new thing they're spraying. They're making them not only Roundup ready, glyphosate, Dow is manufacturing crops that are able to withstand 2,4-D, which is Agent Orange, which is contaminated with dioxin. So the problem is partly genetic modification, where we're releasing all these kind of spliced genes with history cut out, as you mentioned a moment ago, into the gene pool. But when you look at the map, there's an online map about glyphosate spraying, Roundup, this wonderful chemical you see advertised on TV that just kills everything in its path. The country is being basically sprayed with Roundup. And so they love to create these ubiquitous toxins that are so pervasive that there's no escaping them, and there's no accountability because no one knows where they got exposed because they're exposed everywhere.
Right. So now, in a sense, we honor Saturn, right, which is the intelligence of regulation and limitation, why that's a good thing, you know, to honor that quality of Saturn. I love every now and then talking to right-wingers, because we got to talk to everybody. And they say, no, you know, no EPA, no nothing, because I want to play the games that I want to play. And I go, well, games are kind of made up of rules, you know? And they're like, I hadn't thought about that. I go, there's rules on this planet. You know, there's only so much water. You know, that's a limit. That's a rule. And he's like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. So, you know, I think this realm.
It sounds like the mafia lobbying to get rid of the regulatory agency known as the FBI.
Okay.
If I were in the mafia, I would certainly want the FBI done away with, and if I was Monsanto, I'd certainly want the EPA done away with.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, and certainly, you know, it is very scary. I mean, let's honor danger, because there is a kind of crazed rising up of the toxic underwhelm of anger, and it's misdirected, but it is mob mind going, regulations about land, and we should lift it all and drill it all, and so how is you, as a cultural alchemist, you know, how would you like to metabolize and redirect this arousal?
Well, I think we should start with basic community needs, I think. My answer to all the most serious questions of society is to have potluck dinners.
Okay.
I think we need to start with in-person, face-to-face, community meetings where no money is exchanged and we all just give each other food. And we hang out and maybe have them like every Sunday night someplace so that we actually can get a rhythm going and meet each other, feel each other, work with each other, find out what we have to share, what we have to offer. And from these kind of genuine encounters, not virtual community, but actual community where food is eaten, I think we will learn a lot and we'll be able to set agendas both for our local communities and our much larger communities.
Right.
So I think we have to start small and humble and do it well.
Yes, and again to catalyze food is good, and no buying. You know, a friend of mine often complains that at spiritual gatherings of Channels and Lazarus or whatever, people bring cakes from Costco. Going, no cakes from Costco at the spiritual gathering. God, you know, let's get our contradictions, you know, sort of steamed out. But I would also Just want to bring before you and our council here, our Radio Magic dedicated fabulous listenership. I very much like there was a talk at Bioneers, my favorite talk really of last year, aside from my own, but by Kim Stanley Robinson, who's a science fiction writer and a really smart guy. And it was a short talk, but he said, first, enough of the dystopian imagination. We're living that. We want to cultivate the utopian imagination. Yes, yep. We do. We'll come back to Neptune on that and your Pisces self. But, but then he also said, you know, here's how we can do it. And he kind of delineated. Now, I'm eager to read E.L. Wilson's book, which Kim Stanley Robinson referred to. It's coming out right now, called Half Earth, in which this really smart scientist makes a plan for how humans restore half of the Earth to nature. We'll call it parks, right? So humans don't get mad. But, you know, wildlife corridors and everything. But what Kim Stanley Robinson goes into it, he says, well, here's how we can restructure things, you know, with the taxes on assets as well as income. You know, here we go. We can begin to rebuild the infrastructure. It's starting kind of Bernie-ish. And also, he said, we want to change our whole idea about government, really, because we're going to need a collective story and regulatory dynamic. You know, yes, it could be bad, but not if it's us. And he said also, we're going to need global agreements, so there's no hiding place for money, no Cayman Island kind of a thing. And he goes on in great detail about how we can pull off a renaissance. It's quite wonderful. But I think that conversation about, well, and it is part of the Bernie phenomenon, right? Because he's talking about, you know, well, I haven't seen Michael Moore's film, which I really want to. Have you seen it yet?
I have not.
Okay, but we're going to, and most of our audience has, because it's all solutions. And people weep with delight at the beauty of it. And the idea, you know, did you know that in Germany, I mean, you have to get into university, but if you get in, it's free. And that's free to any citizen in the world. If you get into a German university, you do not need to pay tuition for 4 years because they care about education.
Well, I didn't know this. And that was true in our country recently as well. I mean, in the foreign country known as New York City, both of my parents in the 1960s attended Brooklyn College for free. They had to pay, they noted to me they had to pay $5 per semester registration fee, which meant that their entire college education cost $40 plus books. We have that. This is not Bernie Sanders making things up. This is an old promise, not some new idea.
Right. And that's a wonderfully important thing to bring up. You know, yes, that you know that. Good historian. That this was true, that your parents went to college for free.
Yeah. And I went to SUNY for $550 a semester.
Wow.
That was my tuition. So I could go for full time for 1 year for $1,100. And that was even affordable. And it was because the state pitched in toward education. And there was a movement in the 80s and 90s to basically privatize public education. And that's why now students graduate from the State University of New York with debt exceeding $100,000. Unconscionable in the era when I went to school. Now I'm old, but I'm not that old.
No, you're a young whippersnapper. You're a next generation dragon, right? And I do love Ursula Le Guin's quote. She says, "Those who do not listen to dragons are doomed to live out the nightmare of politicians." And your dog agrees. That's good. Chiming in, he's another dog against Monsanto. Very excellent.
Hey, Henrietta, come here.
Henrietta dog. Okay, that's very good. Ancient call of the wild. Yes.
Exactly. She looks like it too, with her fluffy haircut and her pink bow.
No, we have a lot of dog listeners.
She's a wolf.
Yeah, no, and we do have a lot of dog listeners. I mean, many people say my dog loves your show. So Henrietta is just doing a little shout out to the dog listenership, which is completely welcome. As we said backstage, you know, we go out the door and we go, "We're doing it all for you, dogs." That's really what we're doing. But we're gonna take a very short break in a minute or ish. But I did also want to bring up, you know, our allies again in Fresno, Gene Hayes. They're also showing the movie Racing Extinction at Fresno State Friday at 5:30 with Dr. Heather Rally from the film as a discussant, and the workshop again that they're giving 8:30 to 1 p.m. But I don't know if you caught the Pope. You know, go Pope. We discourage the bad, but we encourage the good. The Pope did a collaboration with the movie Racing Extinction, in which they projected onto the Vatican all the images of all the animals and all the flora and fauna of this earth. You know, for hours, and people sat in reverent attunement. We go Pope, go Racing Extinction, go Unusual Collaborations.
Well, well, he is Pope Francis, who's the patron saint of the environment and of animals. And I'm kind of amazed that it took 2,000 years for someone to name themselves Pope Francis. And I thought it was a good sign.
Yeah.
But I was waiting for him to demonstrate that with some actions. And I think he, given his limitations, you know, you're not that power, you know, you're not that free as Pope. But
no,
you are the Pope.
He's breaking free as much. Yeah, that's true. He's in the finite game of constraint and all of that. But within that, and that's why we, you know, some people go, oh, and we go, no, encourage the good. He's doing some interesting good stuff. So yes. We're going to take a very short station ID break in some seconds, like now. Our guest is Eric Francis, and we'll be right back after this very short break. Here we go.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our splendid ally guest this hour is Eric Francis Coppolino, fellow astro-mytho-political investigator. His website is planetwaves.net. So,
and yes. My Pacifica radio program is planetwaves.fm.
Oh, where are you in Pacifica?
I do a show called The Miracle Hour, and we're on one station, WOOL, in Vermont. It's a new show. It's only been six times, but my whole station joined Pacifica.
Excellent! Yay, wool! Yes.
Good. Very excited about that.
Good wool. Well, let's
call Amy Goodman a colleague is wonderful, and you.
Well, there you go. Good. Well, that's right. Well, because Amy and I started the same year. She's just more disciplined and every day I'm once a week. But we started the same year, same month. So I like to call the Visionary Activist Show, it's Democracy Now on Mushrooms. It's the mythological.
I get what you mean by that.
It's the entheogenic version of Democracy Now. So it's democratic animism now. She puts up with that. I got to introduce her at the Symbiosis Festival and she almost smiles.
Very funny. I've seen her smile.
Okay.
Personally.
That's good. And you're sure she wasn't burping? Okay.
No, I'm sure.
Okay, that's very excellent. So back to the realm that we both share with Amy, you know, which is not the astrology part necessarily, but now, you know, when we love the dance of the outer planets, I like to say that they each represent large forces of nature's evolutionary ingenuity, and they're the keepers of the whole big frame story in which we're all in. So there you are. You know, best time ever to be a Pisces. Do you want to speak to Neptune? Do you want to bring Neptune into our conversation?
Well, I think that Neptune in Pisces is awesome, and we all waited a long time for it to get there. It's going to be there for a while, and as you mentioned, Venus is walking up on it right now, and that is a beautifully idealistic, artistic, music, erotic, musical, all the above at once, and that's happening, and it's built into the eclipse and the equinox chart.
Right, and it will be Sunday. Palm Sunday is actually the exact conjunction of Venus and Neptune. Neptune at its stationing degree, I think, but Venus exalted in Pisces. And I'll be at Common Wheel presenting that day. If you want to go to my website and sign up, coyotenetworknews.com. So the Venus Neptune conjunction. We've waited a long time, as you say, for Neptune to enter Pisces. 165 years. There we go.
But there's something else bigger happening, I think.
Aha! Uh-huh, all right.
And that thing I think that's bigger happening is the conjunction of Uranus and Eris, the two naughtiest planets. And they have not had a conjunction since 1925. That was on the Aries point, in the first degree of Aries, in about 1925. And now Uranus has circled back around, and Eris moves very slowly, discovered 2005. It's got about a 550-year orbit. It spends about a fifth of it in Aries, where it is. So pretty soon, everybody born on the planet, unless one of those really old people in Japan, is going to have Uranus in Aries. Eris in Aries, and Uranus, as we know, is in Aries. It entered Aries in 10-11, and now they are going to be conjunct. And this is, I think, one of the great conjunctions of our lifetimes. It is right there with the Uranus-Pluto conjunction of 65-66, and the Uranus-Neptune conjunction.
Oh, you mean equal in terms of its wowness?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like a conjunction. Nothing like a conjunction, right? There's oppositions and squares, but the conjunctions are the ones that say stand up and take note. And they're the aspects that say the times they are changing.
So that will be at 22 plus Aries?
23 plus Aries, just in there. And then it's going to, Aries moves slowly. It's going to dance around, but it'll be within 1 degree of that, and there'll be a total of 3 exact conjunctions. And, of course, the 60s pick up after the Uranus-Pluto conjunction in 65. Things are not that exciting or that interesting in the first half of the 60s. It's the second half of the 60s that are really interesting. And my take from looking at conjunctions where Uranus makes the conjunction or conjunctions where Eris is conjoined, these move the culture. For example, I think last really big conjunction we had to Eris was in the early 70s, Chiron conjunct Eris. That was second wave feminism, women's lib, Roe versus Wade, and it was a huge zeitgeist moment. And though the work is unfinished, it was well begun at that time.
So say a little more about the quality of Eris and also where Eris is actually as a physical body.
As a physical body, Eris is in something called the scattered disk. So it's a planet in the Kuiper Belt that got pulled out by some big thing that's probably lurking out beyond where we can see right now, but orbiting our sun. So something scattered the objects in what is called the scattered disk. And Eris is one of about 10 known objects in the scattered disk. And Eris, to me, is about being subversive. There's a few different characteristics that Eris has. First of all, as a personal factor, I think it's this kaleidoscope of identity that we all live with. It's this kind of postmodern, who the heck am I question that we live with. But then...
Wait. Don't we want to throw the term postmodern into the cauldron? All right, I'm throwing postmodern into the cauldron. Keep going. There's a lot of abstract language flying by here.
It's based in Xena, the warrior priestess. The original name for... that concept is based on the original name for Eris, which was Xena.
Okay.
Named for Xena, the warrior priestess. Mike Brown and people at Caltech who discover these things pretty dependably are very good at naming them. And these are some people who even like astrologers. Mike Brown actually respects what astrologers do. He says we're twin brothers. He's a Gemini, and he describes astrology and astronomy as twins. Well, and he's the Kepler of our day, so that's pretty good, right? He's not some 50-cent astronomer. He's one of the best there is, and he openly advocates for the work astrologers do. That's amazing all by itself.
That is amazing. All right, well, we'll look him up, yeah.
So he and team discovered Eris in 2005, and they originally called it Xena after the TV figure, who's always going from century to century, right? It's not like Twin Peaks where you're always in Twin Peaks. Xena, the warrior priestess, is going to a different era every episode. So we get an image of something that does not need to have coherent regulation around it to have its identity. And so that struck me as a likely point of delineation for Eris. It represents the multiple personalities that we have, the way in which people so often feel fragmented and they can't well describe who they are, and there's no longer this concrete sense of, hi, I'm Anthony, I'm a lawyer, so much as, you're an actor and a lawyer and a gardener and a whatever. And so, but I think Eris goes, the subversive quality of Eris came out in one particular chart, which was the night that Steve Colbert made his presentation to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, in effect, intellectually assassinating Bush and Cheney.
No, not assassinating, wrong word, because the satirist always liberates. But anyway, but yes, that was a great...
It will be an assassination, we'll call it that.
That was fine. That was a great moment.
Belief system and being taken seriously. And So I was sitting in an astrology class one day and with a guy named Rick Tarnas, who's well-loved in Northern California. And he's going over the chart of Steve Colbert. I'm a mundane astrologer wondering what the heck the planets were doing that night. And you have to see this video to appreciate the guts and the cojones it took for Colbert to get up there in front of the entire Washington power structure and basically tear down the entire Bush administration.
It was very impressive. Right. It was very impressive.
Mercury conjunct Eris to the degree.
Uh-huh. So 22 or 23 Aries.
21. It was a few years ago, so it was back a degree or two. But exactly conjunct, and I thought this is a very interesting thing that tips the hand of Eris, a subversive quality, which comes right from the myth.
And also, just as a little footnote, they're bringing Xena back, you know, the TV show, and in this version, they're allowing the full revelation of her, you know, relationship with another woman in an erotic, romantic way. So there we go. There's more Eros. There we go. So yes. That's coming back.
That subversive sex changes everything, and we need to remember that.
That sex changes everything.
Yes.
Oh, well, okay.
It's the catalyst that sets things in motion, that creates every human being. We all come from sex. You, me, Einstein, Babe Ruth, Marilyn Monroe, everyone. We all come from sex.
And the sun, but yes, okay, right, fair enough. Yeah, there are many. There are many.
You know, our immediate, like, you know, where did I come from? Well, there are these people. They went on a honeymoon. So I look at Eris as being subversive as well, and Uranus as a Promethean quality to it. And so we have, you know, Prometheus steals fire from the gods, he's friend of humanity, and now we have Eris and Uranus getting together, and we have two extremely naughty planets, subversive planets getting together. And I see two main possibilities. One, and they're probably going to come true at the same time, one is a wave of awakening of consciousness that seems already to be sweeping through the lands. There's something that's shifted this year. There's something that's shifted as we've come out of the 2012 era into this next kind of spiritual frontier. And the other side of that is that the glamour of technology seems to be swallowing more and more people who are being, like, eaten alive by their iPhones. And I think that Uranus in Aries represents the glamour of technology, perhaps better than anything going on in the sky right now. And so this may kind of implode on one side of the tracks, and on the other side of the tracks, a lot of people wake up. And that's always what happens. I mean, and look, we were seeing this finally, some real bifurcation, not like Mitt Romney versus Obama, but a camp gathering around Trump. Of you know, one type of consciousness and a camp gathering around Sanders of another type of consciousness.
But a lot of, I think this is our job, everybody listening, everybody here cahooting, because I do love the NPR interview with ardent Trump supporter going, out of work, unhappy, alcoholic, you know, white working class guy outside Las Vegas. You know, he goes, Trump just makes me feel better. I am for the legalization of cannabis, but I'm still supporting Trump. And the interviewer said, but if Trump disappeared, who would you vote for? And he goes, Bernie, of course. Anyway, so I don't think there's many Bernie people who go Trump-wise, but no. I think part of our dynamic is, again, come on over here, there you go. There could be that, because they're drawn to, again, the story, and they're drawn to the story of how we're being snookered, and they're drawn to the corruption thing, and there's some weird little points of agreement. You know, he's the toxic mimic. I mean, he's the con man. And so we go, that's very good. So we want to, you know, again, it's, you know, all power to the storytellers. A lot of progressive teams, and certainly astrologer teams, have been miserable at storytelling, right? They're like, and left the storytelling and the religion, you know, to the right wing. And so it behooves all of us who care about the world, you know, to deepen our eloquence and our capacity to tell story. And in an invitational, non-confrontational way, still deep delving, but going, come on over, there you go.
Astrology is about something else. And that something else is the thing we need to tell the story of. So astrology represents things. It's a set of symbols that stand for something else. That's what we need to be focused on.
Well, can you make it less abstract?
Sure. Astrology is a bunch of symbolic references. They're planets with names. They make aspects and so forth. Well, so I'm describing Uranus conjunct Eris and Aries and speculating about some possibilities about that, some of which are based on noticing real movement in the culture, signs of what look like, you know, festering, effervescing, possibly fermenting revolutions, where I think a lot of people are recognizing that something has to change.
Yeah.
And this is Uranus Eris. Something has to change, and it is us, because it's in Aries.
Right. And yeah, as Saturn and Sagittarius would say, you know, to everybody, again, you know, there's no one story, no one storyteller, no one anything. It's all part of the symphony. So that is a crucial and wonderful dynamic. I like also Jupiter transiting the Uranus-Pluto conjunction of the 60s. I think of those born in the 60s. That would be you. It's kind of like a sleeper cell, right? Okay, the time is now, you know, and those, you know, living through the 60s going, all right, it's time. There's, you know, as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So we have a lot going on from 60s to now, going a lot of resonance. Even the Trump, you know, scary phenomenon that's got the riots in Chicago, right? You got there's a lot of that, and so, but you know, but it need not be a repetition. It wants to be a maturation, like the Uranus-Pluto conjunction. This is kind of like the first quarter of integrating that, so there's actual equality between men and women, actual equality between Mars and Venus, actual equality between humans and the rest of beings on this planet.
No one can be given equality. They have to take it.
Well, what does that mean?
It means that nobody makes me a great author. I have to get up and write every day.
Well, that's not equality. That's cultivation.
Right. That means that I believe equality has to be cultivated. No one is going. You can't tell people who are struggling with self-esteem and the question of whether they even have a right to exist that they should be equal to anything. I think that the right to investigate yourself and express yourself is pretty darn close to equality. And once you've done that, no one gave you what you are. You became what you are. You chose to be a person who can stand up to the world and hold the integrity of your own message, which you do brilliantly. No one gave you that, though. No one said, oh, hi, Caroline, now you're equal.
Well, I think we might want
to... I'm going to do this.
Well, yes, I think we might be defining equality as a little different deal. Like the teachings of Stella Coyote, my companion of many years, half coyote dog. What I love about that is that what she is here to teach humans, being a between worlds person, is that dogs know shame, but coyotes know no shame. It's all negotiation, and it's all intrinsically equal in some way. Now, it's true, I have the house and the food and I have the car keys. But it's a telepathic going, I'll give you this. How about that? I'll give you this. How about that? I think it's a hum of intrinsicness. It's not cultivation. Like you cultivate your incredible prolific self of dedicated, not missing an issue in 18 years. That's very impressive.
And Monogram magazine. And it's now 20 years.
Okay. 20 years. Okay. Your bio needs updating. Ha! Ha! You're not on top of everything. Okay, so 20 years. There we go. There's cultivation, you know, and what we do with it. But I think in here, let me run this by you. So I love, you know, Uranus as, you know, trickster, ingenuity, and the last ideas associated with it are democracy, equality, synchronicity. And I thought, well, what do those guys have to do with each other? And immediately events became staged so that it was very clear that we can all have different roles and be more or less cultivated, be on the radio or listening or teaching or not, you know. But backstage, there's a fundamental equality. And when we treat each other as equals, meaning direct straight across, hi, how you doing, Mr. Dog, Mr. Coyote, Mr. Eric, you know, the rate of synchronicity increases dramatically. And from working with Stella, I go, well, may all, and your doggies, you know, may all of our relationships be a contract of reciprocal blessing and mutual evolution with a kind of respect. It doesn't mean that your dog can write a column. Equal does not mean same, but it means
you can
just
certainly help me write a column, though.
Oh, no, there you go. That's right.
I mean, no, really, to have love in the room all the time makes a big difference to a writer.
No, that's a really great point. Okay, and we can sort of leave that for the moment. Going there, we have it. There and there we have resolved nothing, and we're moving on. But the dogs got us out of that one. But also let's speak to this powerful time of equinox, which humans have celebrated for 25 to 30,000 years by inviting light of sun in to go down the stairway and animate the snake, or come on in sun and illumine this painting or this writing at the back of the cave. It's humans calling in power and going, come on in, literal metaphoric sun, and animate this story, right? So what
here's my story.
Yeah.
Eclipse in Libra. Mercury, Sun, and Aries, and then there's an eclipse in Libra. To me, the eclipse in Libra is saying we need a new concept of relationship that can contain what you're calling equality. The current construct of relationship does not support that. It's inherently imbalanced, and the power is not distributed evenly.
Meaning where? So, what? I mean, yes, probably.
Meaning the dominant paradigm concept of what a relationship is supposed to be. I don't want to get partisan here on the polymonogamy question, but there are a lot of inherent issues in relationships, the way that we are force-fed them. And they're kind of genetically modified relationships that don't really reflect the natural social tendencies of human beings, which are much more exploratory and curious than we are basically allowed to. And in my vision of this eclipse, the eclipse of the moon in Libra is talking about shifting a level of need to another place, to really understand what we actually need in relationships. And it's not to handcuff another person, to control another person with money or with sex, but rather to shift the level of need. A lot of the control drama and jealousy and obsession over money and resources is hooked in on a level of need, so-called need. And I think that the moon describes that kind of need, typically, in several different contexts of astrology, and it's the need we need to shift. We need to need something different. And I think the emphasis needs to come back on what a person is and on the value of some autonomy. Mercury, Sun conjunct one another in Aries is really about self-consciously, shamelessly being oneself. Start the relationship from there.
Well, what does that mean? Your dog wants to edit.
wait, what do you mean, what does it mean?
Well, let's just.
I don't understand the concept of meaning. I'm sorry.
Okay. A new concept of relationship. That's great. Okay. And everybody's got a Venus and a Mars in a different place. Everybody's a unique experiment. Some people love polyamory, Venus and Gemini, mutable signs. Some people Venus Taurus. They're really quite happy for 40 years. Some people want to experiment.
I have Venus and Taurus, and I'm quite polyamorous.
Well, there you go. You're a sensual. Again, what did our last week's guest call it? Something the evolutionary drive of hedonism in a good way. Fabulous. All right, so
maybe since we need to have conversations, maybe we need somebody who likes jazz on Thursday and somebody who likes rock on Friday, and that's really what's at the heart of polyamory,
which is to have a wide realm of intimate ranging good. A renaissance.
Yeah, kind of a renaissance. And what if you're just the kind of person who thinks a lot of different people are beautiful and interesting?
Excellent.
And you like to experience that without feeling guilt or like you're in prison.
That's good. Well, so do you have
this
that?
What's that?
And so do you have that in a happy, good?
I do.
Excellent.
I would say that I do. There's always further you can go and more refined and all that and better at it. But I would say that I've guided my life in that direction and I have arrived at a place like that. So, yes.
Excellent, that is a whole and wonderful realm. Freedom for everybody. Excellent, very good. Each according to their own affinity. Well, but it's moving. It's moving more that way. I mean, there is really when you think about it on one level, it's like another level. The level of tolerance that is moved in terms of cannabis legalization and gay marriage happening and the transgendered complexity and the welcoming of the twin-souled beings and the Bear Dash. fresh, long-exiled shamanism of the yep. twin-souled spirit. And so it's slow and amazing, both, in terms of there you have it. Now, we're not in Saudi Arabia, but in this kind of realm of Renaissance, there's and you, quite happily so, nobody's constraining your desire to cavort, right?
No, as long as I understand my needs and I'm able to establish level of what you're calling equality in my relationships, which starts with me being a person.
Well, and it's
hard to think of yourself as equal if you don't think of yourself as a person.
And
I assure you, there's a lot of people who haven't figured out yet that they're people and are right on the brink of doing that.
What does that mean, figure out that you're a person?
Well, it's kind of like in The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, where she talks about how a woman is a social construct, but a female is a biological construct. And there's a difference between a woman and a person. It's a different social construct. And she's suggesting that, for example, we're talking about feminism, that really feminism is the journey from being a woman to being a person. And that's what you identify as. And so the discovery that you are a person, what used to be called in the 70s personhood, even in some models of therapy now, including Lacombe therapy and internal family systems, personhood is a real thing, and that's the thing that we're aspiring to. And if we were to concentrate on that idea of personhood, what I think of as being sentient self-awareness, that would advance everything very quickly, spiritually, psychologically, socially, artistically.
Say that last little bit again. I was distracted by a thought coming in from our last week's guest, going, random acts of hedonism. Excellent. Random acts of hedonism. There we go.
Hey, that sounds like fun.
And exactly. Well, we like random acts of hedonism and kinship and cavorting and mangoes and fur and all of that. But the last thing you said, say again.
If I can remember it.
Oh, okay.
That as we emerge into personhood, if the goal is personhood, not to be a dude or a chick or a this or that, but rather to aspire to be a person, feeling your presence on the planet as a person with all of the beauty and challenge that implies, I think that is the thing that is the most likely social catalyst, relationship catalyst, creative catalyst. Think about what artists do. Artists make art, but they spend a lot of time cultivating their personhood through the cultivation of art. So artists often have both going on a parallel track. Yes, I'm an artist, and yes, I am cultivating my personhood as I do this.
I don't know what your dog would think about this, or Stella Coyote uh-huh. exactly, going, I'm all for throwing humanism into the cauldron, humans as the measures of all things, going, no, we're all sort of syncretized. And maybe, you know, one of the things that distinguishes our species, aside from our rudeness, is our capacity to borrow qualities of intelligence from plants and animals, that we're all
yes.
kind of, we're kind of Saturn, we're a container of Neptunian vastness, you know,
yes.
each one a wonderful experiment, but all kinned. I mean, you're a part of the whole world. We're a part of the whole world, and so we go, well, personhood if you want, you know, but I wouldn't park on that.
I don't mean it prejudicially in terms of excluding excluding dogs or cats.
Right, exactly.
They are part of our
peoplehood.
Personhood, and we're part of their animalhood, and I think these distinctions are only useful as far as they go. But I'm saying for people listening, and there's some dogs listening, hello, that self-actualization matters, and we don't really talk about that much anymore.
Oh, we talk about it way too much.
commonly used and aspired to thing a generation ago. So by personhood, I mean self-actualization. I mean claiming the right to exist, claiming your couple of inches on the bookshelf.
We must leave now, but it's even mid-conversation, but we're stirring it up. That's excellent.
It goes on at Planet Waves FM.
Excellent.
PlanetWaves.fm.
PlanetWaves.fm. That's wonderful. I'm Caroline Casey. I'm journeying out to California, my other home. Hello, team. I will see you all possibly in Point Reyes on Saturday, also in Bolinas on Sunday, 4 to 6 p.m., CoyoteNetworkNews.com.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you very much. Woof, woof, woof. Thanks always to Yasha in Washington, D.C., and Alex Brewinskis in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. See you over the weekend, perhaps. Woof. Thanks, Eric.
Love. Bye for now.
Bye.
He is one stunningly unique character, this Leonard Pitt. Lenny. His Detroit to Paris to Berkeley life, brilliantly described in his new book, My Brain on Fire, Paris and Other Obsessions, is fascinating. He grew up a total misfit in pre-Ritalin Detroit, got himself to Paris, studied mime while living in a garret, becoming an artist, falling in love with the City of Light, then Berkeley. Start to finish, Kirkus says, his memoir is a lively, autodidactic romp through a life well-lived in both mind and body. He'll be at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley, Wednesday evening, March 30th at 7:30. Writer Tom Farber will host this KPFA benefit. There is wheelchair access. Advance tickets at brownpapertickets.com and our indie bookstores. Full info, kpfa.org, March 30th, Leonard Pitt.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 3 p.m. Stay tuned next for Cover to Cover with Richard Walensky.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Hanya Yanagihara, whose latest novel is titled A Little Life. Earlier novel, The People in the Trees. Hanya Yanagihara is the deputy editor of T Magazine, which is the style magazine of the New York Times, wrote for Condé Nast Traveler. This particular book, A Little Life, deals at the beginning, at least, with four young men, later kind of contracts into the story of one of them, set in New York. You wrote a novel, as you said before we went on the air, it went nowhere,
right.
Though got very good reviews, and then you're searching around. What brought you to the story of Jude St. Francis and his friends set in New York?
It was a few things. You know, I had always had this character in my head of someone who would never get better. And I kind of thought, what if you upended the narrative tension of a typical naturalistic novel, which this book sort of is and sort of isn't, in which the character begins at point A and ends at point Z, and there is some sort of, typically but not always, some sort of emotional growth or understanding that the protagonist reaches. And I thought, what if the character started off at A and tried and tried and tried and ended at A as well? What would be the narrative tension of that book, and how could you really make it thrilling for the reader? So that was the first sort of idea and the textual idea of the book. But I also wanted to, and I didn't really realize this until I began writing, sort of write an homage to the way that my friends and I live now. You know, none of us are married among my close friends. None of us have children. And the adulthood that we lead is sort of seen as a not quite adulthood, a liminal stage between childhood and adulthood. And yet it is the way that many of us in cities do live. And it is a perfectly, I think, acceptable and legitimate form of adulthood. In that sense, I do consider the book in its own way a political book. It's not a sort of life that I see depicted in fiction that much, and I wanted to make it for me and my friends, actually.
The main characters are four men. You're a woman, and of the four men, two, possibly three, possibly two, depending upon
right.
what you're looking at, are gay. It's multicultural. Two of the characters are African-American, then their friends are Asian and all sorts of different people.
Right.
So it is that. What struck me in reading A Little Life, though, beyond all of the stories within it, which are very intense, I guess you'd call them, the book takes place over several decades. yet it seems to start in around 2016 and end in around 2016. I guess that was absolutely deliberate.
Yes. One of the first decisions I made about this book, the first I made was the structure, and I knew exactly how it would unfold. But I also wanted it to have the sort of quality of a fairy tale. And this book is really about the marriage of two very different genres. It's about the contemporary naturalistic novel, and it's the fairy tale. And in a lot of the absences in this book, the absence of history, the absence of historical events, the absence of parents, you know, the absence of sort of redemption, the absence of happiness to some extent, the suffering of a child, you know, the motherlessness that runs throughout the book, are all borrowed from the fairy tale. And then, of course, the way the characters think and move, how they're educated, what they feel entitled to, that's naturalistic. But when you remove time from a book, when you remove historical markers, what you effectively do is you trap the reader in a sort of vacuum-sealed container in which the only world they have to concentrate on is the emotional life of these four characters. And it is, I hope, what gives the book its sense of intimacy, but equally, I hope it gives the book a sense of claustrophobia. But I wanted the reader to feel really lost in the book, you know. So another decision I made was